For most families out there, school starts this week, and so I'm very glad that I was able to schedule today's guest, who happens to teach fifth grade in Los Angeles at one of the nation's largest inner-city grade schools, Hobart Elementary. Now, as you listen today, I invite you to think about your own kids and their teachers and their schools. Is it possible to make more classrooms like Rafe Esquith's? And if so, how do we do it? At Hobart, Rafe Esquith leads fifth graders through an uncompromising curriculum: English, mathematics, geography, literature. The classroom motto is, be nice, work hard, there are no shortcuts. At the end of the semester, every student performs in a full-length Shakespeare play. And despite language barriers and poverty, many of these Hobart Shakespeareans move on to attend outstanding colleges. Esquith has very strong ideas about educating today's children of immigrants. He insists on expecting the best from these kids, no matter what their backgrounds, and he backs up that expectation by giving them the educational resources to defy the odds. I'm going to quote him here. I fear something for these children, and it's not gangs. It's not drugs. What I fear is that they be ordinary. I don't want my students to be ordinary. I want them to be extraordinary because I know that they are. If a 10-year-old who doesn't speak English at home can step in front of you into a scene from Shakespeare, then there's nothing he cannot accomplish. Rafe Esquith grew up in Los Angeles, and he attended the city's public schools. He's a 1981 graduate of UCLA, and he's taught fifth grade at Hobart Boulevard Elementary in L.A. for over 22 years. He's the only teacher in history to receive the National Medal of Arts. He's also been made a member of the British Empire by Queen Elizabeth. And his efforts to give disadvantaged kids a better chance at the American dream have earned him the American Teacher of the Year Award, Parents Magazine's As You Grow Award, and the Compassion in Action Award from the Dalai Lama. He's donated his award money to the nonprofit fund he has established to support the work of the Hobart Shakespeareans. Welcome back, Rafe Esquith.
Thanks for having me on the show, Terry.
What was your path to teaching and to what you're doing today at Hobart Elementary?
Well, it was the most ordinary path of all. I basically started working in summer camp because I wanted to make a few dollars so I could take women out when I was a teenager. I never thought I would have a particularly special classroom. I liked working with students, so I became a teacher. But then I became very upset when I worked at a poor school like Hobart and met children who were capable, like you said, of great things, of doing better, and they weren't. Today, only 32% of the children at Hobart even finish high school. Now, that either means we have the stupidest children on the planet or our system is failing. And I think everybody listening knows the answer to that one. So I have struggled for 25 years now to do, as you said, to find possible answers as to why it's happening and what I can do differently. And I think there's one good thing about my story, and you laugh at me, Terry, but I am an ordinary teacher. I'm a very ordinary guy, and yet sometimes I've been able to make a difference. And I think that's why teachers like to listen to me, because they think, if Rafe can do it, I can do it.
Right, and you've started speaking more to teachers than you used to, right? In other words, this publicity has had a very positive side.
Well, and a negative side as well. I used to become disenchanted when I saw other teachers, good teachers, who got publicity, but then they kind of sold their souls. They left the classroom and they let Hollywood make the movie about them, and they get their website and they're making millions of dollars, but they're not really helping children. It's really all about them. So I was determined to use the publicity I get to help other teachers and other children, because there are great teachers out there, and a lot of them are young, and they tell me nobody mentors them. The only time they ever see anybody is when they get criticized. And listen, when you're 24 years old and you're struggling, a pat on the back or somebody with a constructive suggestion works a lot better than somebody telling you that your bulletin board isn't straight or that your kids aren't all sitting up straight.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I think I mentioned to you when we met the first time, I started out as a school teacher myself. And I'm one of the ones who did leave the classroom because I wanted to reach larger audiences. But now I feel like I'm still teaching.
Everybody teaches. You're still a teacher.
Yeah. So in one of your books, you mention a turning point. And for people who sort of go, oh, this guy is a natural, you know, it can't happen here, that sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about the turning point in which you thought maybe you weren't cracked up for this?
Well, basically, it was happening because I was achieving what I thought was success in getting fifth and sixth graders up to a very high grade level, only to discover that 2-3 years later, they were in gangs and drugs. And here I am, a National Teacher of the Year, and people are writing articles about what a wonderful teacher I am. And I know it's a lie. And I realize that as teachers today, and we're really guilty of it now, with no child left behind, we always assess the children at the end of the year. We give them the test, you know, and if the kid goes from 75 to 85, we feel that we've done our job. But I learned that the real assessment is, where are these children's 10 years after they've left the classroom? What have I given them, not for the test, but skills that they'll use for the rest of their lives? And we don't assess that because there's no money in it. The testing services can't make money. And it's harder to assess that. But just because it's harder doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing it. So I track my students. I watch them. I stay in touch with them. I just took my former fifth grade class from 7 years ago, or excuse me, 6 years ago, on a college tour. And we were up at Stanford and Berkeley. And it was great to see these little ones now as great young adults. And the best part was that when we were at Stanford and Berkeley, we were taken around by my former students who now attend Stanford and Berkeley. And I would suggest, Terry, that's a better assessment than your SAT score.
Absolutely. Now, one of the things that you actually say is that one of the real important factors in your class success is your former students.
It's the huge factor. Many young people today, the little kids growing up in an impoverished neighborhood, they don't have a vision for what they can be. I have a vision, but how can a 10-year-old have that vision if all he knows is poverty and violence? I always tell people, if you watch a cooking channel, they show you a wonderful dish, a dessert or a meal, and you really want to eat it, and they say, now here's how we're going to make it. But they show you the finished product to get you excited. But my little 10-year-olds, they've never seen the finished product. But when my former students come back from high school and college and show them the possibilities, they become extremely motivated. So I often get credit for motivating them, but in reality, it's the former students who are the ones that motivate these children. So when kids in the neighborhood laugh at my students who are working hard and say, oh, you're a schoolboy, nobody cares about school, my children can say, well, maybe nobody who you know cares about school, but I've met people who speak my language, who come from my country, and now they're at top universities, and I'm going to be there one day too because they showed me the way.
You say, and it's one of the lines in your new book, Teach Like Your Hair's on Fire, you say, most classrooms today are managed by one thing and one thing only, fear. You also say that if your class is not in order, nothing good will follow. There will be no learning. Character cannot be built. For parents, students, teachers who are about to start the school year, how do you manage that? Because it seems to me that what's holding so many teachers back and so many classrooms back is the need for order.
Absolutely. I'm the toughest teacher you ever met. But I learned early that as a 6-foot-tall man, I can get a 10-year-old to do what I want him to do. I can scare him to death. But it's not effective teaching. He's not going to really listen to me during math or geography or how to throw a baseball unless he trusts me. Terry, one of the things we're doing wrong is most of the books that young people are reading and parents are reading are The First Days of School or How Do You Do That First Week. But what I tell young teachers, they say, Rafe, your class is so great. I wish I could see you on day one. And I tell them, you know, day one looks a lot like day 91. We don't have that one eureka moment. I tell the kids on the first day that we're going to base our class on trust and not fear. And I'm going to earn your trust. And I earn that trust by not going ballistic on them over minutiae. I tell them, yes, you're going to forget your homework sometimes. Yes, you're going to screw up the math test or spill the paint. And no, I don't like that. But it's not a huge issue for me. Those are fixable things. But if you break trust, if you tell me, Rafe, I need to go to the bathroom, but then you're not at the bathroom, I can't trust you anymore. And you can never get that back. A broken trust is irreparable. It's the one sin in my classroom. And I earn their trust by always answering questions. And if I say that we're going to have an art project, we really do. I don't make excuses. And by consistently being patient and kind, remember, I've got to be the person I want them to be. I want them to work hard. They got to work hard.
As you said, the students who come back are their models, and you also consider yourself a model.
I have to be. You know, the students can imitate me. It's hilarious, Terry. They've got me down. They've got every mannerism down. They know what I'm going to say before I do. But the key is, if you ask my students, you know, what do you like about Ray's class? They rarely say, oh, he's a genius or he's smart. What they say is he's fair and he's reasonable. And to a 10-year-old, those are huge issues, huge issues. We all remember from our own childhood when a teacher was mean or unfair. It scars us forever. So usually when I have to come down on a kid or exclude him from an activity, maybe we're playing baseball, for example, and somebody's yelling at another kid, which is not, you know, excusable in my classroom. You can't be mean to people. So I'll tell a child, you know, you're not ready to play baseball today. You're going to sit this one out. And if the child says, can I play tomorrow? Of course you can. That way he has an opportunity to rectify his wrong, but he also has to pay for what he's done. But the fair part is, we have teachers today who you don't do your homework, and they say, okay, you're not playing baseball today. There's no connection there. So if you're misusing science equipment, the logical consequence is you're going to have to sit out of today's science experiment. That's reasonable and fair. And the challenge to teachers is to make your lesson so exciting that the punishment is the missing of the lesson itself.
Aha. Uh-huh. I can imagine that one doesn't happen everywhere. Now, I heard you say what you said, which is that you have it set up that the classroom is based on trust. It's based on respect, kindness, all of those sorts of things. The mottos that I said at the top, be nice, work hard. When you were first making your shift, again, I'm trying to speak to those people out there.
Right.
God, you know, now when someone comes into your fifth grade class at Hobart, they kind of know it's special, don't they?
Oh, they're overwhelmed.
Because they've never heard from other kids and stuff.
Sure.
But when you were first making the shift to that you were going to teach by trust rather than fear, how did you do it then?
Well, I tried and I did it badly because the kids weren't buying what I was selling it. You know, just because you say, trust me, or this is going to be great, why would they believe it? I think one of the things people learn from me is I've stayed put for 25 years. So that trust comes slowly. You know, we have that expression, there are no shortcuts. This is a fast food society. And there are young teachers who come to me and say, Rafe, I want what you have, and I want it right now. And I tell them, I'm sorry, you can't have that. You're going to have to pay your dues. And the beautiful thing about teaching is that I do get to kids now that 15 years ago I didn't get. Because I've learned from my own mistakes. It's not that I'm so good at it, but I try to learn from my failures. And by doing that, I do reach children now that I didn't reach before, and that's a wonderful feeling.
So let me go to one of the last questions I was going to ask, but I think it's so central. I'm going to ask you, if you were speaking to a listener out there who's a parent and whose kid is about to start school, what advice would you give them, then a teacher, and then a student?
Well, for the parents, number one, and I'm a father of four.
Ah.
I'm very concerned about our culture today and what we value. You know, the Los Angeles Dodgers are amazing because they become patrons of my class. They're incredible. And they give us great seats for the kids because I'm a baseball junkie. Ned Coletti himself, their general manager, talks with my students when we come.
Oh.
He's a great guy. But I, as a parent, I go to these games and I notice what I call the screens, which is between innings now, we don't talk to each other. We have to watch the screen. We have to be entertained 24/7. We, on buses now, on public transit, they have television screens in the supermarket. And what I tell parents—
At gas stations.
Everywhere. It's terrifying to me. It reminds me of Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, where you've got the parlor walls surrounding you. So I tell parents, let's keep our kids away from screens as often as possible. Let's talk to our children. If we're at a baseball game between innings, let's talk about who's winning and what strategy, and the Dodgers going to switch pitchers. It's an opportunity to show them the game. And that's, you know, a metaphor for anything you're doing. But there's too many screens right now. And I would just tell the parents, we need to spend more time with our children talking to them and listening to them. For the young teachers, what I tell them is there are heroes in your school. Maybe they don't get their name in the paper the way I do, but they're just as good as I am. And they've quietly gone into a classroom for 20 years, making differences in children's lives. And nobody consults them. But they should be consulted. They're very good at what they do. When I was a young teacher, when I had time off, I watched other teachers. I learned from them. I took their ideas. So for the young teachers, since you're not going to be looking at the screens, look at other teachers and learn from them.
So in other words, you're a young teacher. Ask around. Try to get the idea. Many Who's been here a while? Many, who many, seems to make it work?
Absolutely. Many of my best ideas. People love the problem solving I do. But it's not mine. I learned it from a great teacher named Randy Charles. I watched Randy. He was the best math teacher I ever saw. People love the science that I do. I was a terrible science teacher when I began. My own daughter, who's an oncologist, watched me teach science. She thought I was the worst science teacher she ever saw. She devastated me, Terry, but she was right. And through her help and watching other science teachers, I got better at it. The one thing I want young teachers to know, when you ask for help, it doesn't mean you're a bad teacher. You're going to have bad days. You're going to have days where you go home, even when you've done everything right, and the kids still aren't listening. It doesn't mean you're a bad teacher. It means that you have a very hard job, and good teachers learn from those bad days to try to get better at it.
So what advice would you give a student about, okay, they've had a good summer, they're going back to school. School in LA for a lot of kids is tough.
It is tough. There are two pieces of advice I give, and they both come from my former students who taught me this. I had a great student who's now a teacher, by the way, and she went to Penn. And she once talked to my class, and she told them, when you have a chance to join activities, join the things you're terrible at, which blew my mind. She said, I was a very shy child, so I joined the debate team. She said, I was not a good athlete, so I joined the cross-country team. She said, there were things I was really good at. Why join them? I'm already good at them. That's what most people do. She told them to strengthen their weaknesses.
Well, by the way, there's a movie out right now called Rocket Science.
Right.
And
I've
it's about a stutterer who joined, in real life, the director
Absolutely.
Was a stutterer who joined this public speaking and debate team. And that's what the movie is about as well.
And when people say, how did you get to Penn? She said, I strengthened my weaknesses. The other advice I give young people that's hilarious also comes from one of my students who went to Notre Dame. And what she told my class was find the most popular kids you can in school and avoid them. And she said their popularity is always based on false values that may be valuable in the fifth or the seventh grade, but not valuable in real life.
Wow.
And I thought that was an amazing piece of advice. She told them, usually the best kids in school are the ones who are not popular or not cool, but they're the ones who wind up very successful. So those are the advice that I give the kids.
Okay, so that's what you'd give a kid who's about to start school this week. There's a story behind both of the titles of your books, Teach, There Are No Shortcuts, and Teach Like Your Hair Is on Fire. Those stories.
Well, Teach Like Your Hair Is on Fire happened because I actually once, when I was feeling down one day, as happens to teachers, I had a little child who was... I love this kid, and she was the kind of kid that nobody noticed. She was always the last one picked for the team, and we were doing a science project, and her alcohol lamp wouldn't burn, and I got mad at myself because she was crying, and that morning I felt bad about some things that were going wrong in my classroom, but looking at her tears, I realized how selfish I had been, that her tears were more important than my own problems, and I was determined to help her light this alcohol lamp, and in bending over, I set my hair on fire. But I was so excited that I got her lamp working that I didn't realize my hair was burning until she was screaming. But I thought that became kind of a nice moment, because if I cared so much that I didn't know that my hair was burning, I was probably moving in a good direction as a teacher.
Yeah. So, I know that you mentioned that that's like when an athlete is in the zone.
It's true. And all teachers, we face so much adversity on the front lines with you know, administration and pacing plans and bureaucracy, that it's easy to forget that those little ones in front of you, they are the only issue. And once I realized that, I was able to block out all that stuff and focus on what matters.
Yeah. If people want more information about that kind of stuff, I recommend it's impossible to say to get his name from what I'm going to say, but Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who's written about flow. And hard to, you know, look up flow, but there's some wonderful stuff there in how, what it is that gets us into that zone.
Right. And what happens is when you can get into that zone and you start to realize you really can make a difference, things that seem so important before, you know, some administrator comes into your room, and I work with some good people, but there are a few that, you know, Will Rogers never met, but they don't bother me anymore because I've got better things to do with my time. I'm working with that kid with her alcohol lamp. So once you get into that zone, you become a better teacher because your energy is spent on the important issues.
Yeah, and it also reminded me, the best acting teacher, one of the best acting teachers I ever had back in the period when I was an actor, he said the secret to creativity is to take your attention off yourself.
Right. There it is. That's exactly right. And, you know, it's interesting, but as a young teacher, you think it's about you. You're working so hard. And when I realized, you know, this isn't about me. These little 10-year-olds don't care about my problems. It has to be about them. Interestingly enough, if you look at the cover of Teach Like Your Hair Is on Fire, one of the only disagreements I ever had with Penguin was that they wanted a shot of me in the studio, the glamour shot. And I said, no, you should shoot it in the classroom with the kids. And they said, yeah, but Rafe, your room is so cluttered. And I said, well, I'm a teacher. Of course my room is cluttered. The teachers will understand. And they got a great candid shot of me talking to my kids about the six levels of moral development. But there's a baseball glove out and there's guitars out and the kids are not all sitting up straight. It looks like a real classroom.
They're not sitting at all. They're all gathered around you, which would drive most teachers crazy.
Nah, I love those kids. We have a lot of fun together.
Yeah. Let me tell people again that you're listening to Free Forum. This is KPFK. I'm Terry McNally speaking with Rafe Esquith, and he is a teacher in the LA system who's been in the same fifth grade for how many years now?
This is going to be 26.
Oh, my God. And he's written a couple of books, There Are No Shortcuts and Teach Like Your Hair's on Fire. There's a lot of information at a website called HobartShakespeareans.org. And I'm going to tell you a couple of other things. For audios of this and previous shows, you can go to temcnally.livedigital.com. Look for content and audio. It will also be archived for 90 days at kpfk.org. Check audio archives and scroll down by date and time. And I want to mention one other thing. I first met Rafe when the film, The Hobart Shakespeareans, played on POV on PBS. Well, there's a new film on POV this week that I want to recommend to you. It's called Made in L.A., and it airs next Sunday night on KCET, tonight on most PBS stations. Los Angeles is now the country center for apparel manufacturing, and too many of the places where that's done look like New York's early 20th century sweatshops. Made in L.A. is a portrait of this other California, where immigrant workers work 14-hour days for as little as $3 an hour. And the film, as I say, PBS nationally tonight, Sunday, September 9th at 10:30 on KCET. It focuses on three garment workers and the fight that they waged for 3 years with their union to bring a clothing retailer to the negotiating table. So I just happened to thought that was interesting.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah. So what can we learn? I know I keep sort of thinking this as I read your books, as I think about having you on. What you do, and let me say a couple of things that you do. You come in how early each morning?
I come in early. I come in about 6 in the morning.
And you leave about?
About 5 or 6 at night.
Okay. And you have kids who are willing to do the same?
They come in about 6:30 and they stay till about 5.
And some of them are the kids who are in your fifth grade. Some of them are kids who aren't in your fifth grade anymore,
right,
but come back anyway.
Right. And fourth graders come in as well, early and late. I want everybody welcome to the party. This is not an elitist classroom. All the kids at my school matter. And we have great kids there.
Okay, so when you, as you've just been doing, are going around the country talking to other teachers, when I'm trying to say, what can we take from what you do that can help solve these incredible problems we face today?
Right. Well, the reason Teach Like Your Hair is on Fire has the subtitle, The Methods and the Madness. It's divided into sections. The madness section is for certifiable teachers like me that want to cut off their arms and legs. But, Terry, there are great teachers out there, and they've got childcare issues. They've got to leave school at 3 o'clock. They can't give up their whole life, but they still want to be effective. So in the methods section, whether it's math or literature, I have little things that anybody can do to make their class a little bit more joyous. That's a word that people describe who've been in room 56, that there's a lot of joy there. Yes, the kids work very hard. They work very hard. But I don't see why joy and working hard have to be mutually exclusive. So, for example, there's a brilliant math lady named Marcy Cook, and I use her materials. They're easy, and they're easy to get. A lot of teachers have never heard of her. Once you use her materials, your math lessons become more fun, and the kids learn more. Teachers are very frustrated with Basel readers today. They're so boring. People want to know how I read literature with kids. How do I have the time to design questions and things? Well, there's a company that's in this book that I use all the time to help me supplement my literature program. So I would say, especially to the young teachers, the method section of the book will really be helpful to you.
Okay, great. Because as we go back 2-3 years ago, I don't remember that distinction, but I think that makes sense.
Well,
everybody is going to do are going to be able to.
And I've learned that traveling around the country. I've met thousands of fabulous teachers, and I don't think everybody should do what I do.
Let me ask, this is a very different question. Your father died when you were in fourth grade.
Yeah.
When you look back and think that you've now been in fifth grade for 26 years, is there something?
It's absolutely true. It's absolutely connected for that. And you're a very wise man to ask. I didn't know it when I started. I didn't know. People asked, before I was a well-known teacher, what fueled me? I had no desire to be famous, or I certainly wasn't going to make money doing it. And I didn't realize until years later it was all about the death of my father and the pain that I went through in missing him. I have a great love of baseball. One of my earliest childhood experiences, because he pitched college baseball, was watching him throw me a curveball. And it was so astonishing to me to watch my father do what the major leaguers could do. It was a great moment for me. And on that Wednesday when I came home to find out he was dead, I still miss him. One of my great sadnesses in life was he never got to see me teach. And I think that because of the grade level I teach and the field with which I teach, I do think it has to do with the missing of my father.
Wow. Wow. You also say he was quite a courageous man.
Well, that's the other thing. He was called by the House Un-American Activities Committee. I'm proud to say he refused to name names and did not lose his job, actually. But even after he died, I cannot tell you how many people came up to me to thank me for being his son, for people he protected. And I didn't realize at the time, but his insistence on justice and keeping the playing field level, I think, is very present in my classroom these days.
Let's make this the last question. There's an awful lot of anti-immigrant talk in this country. I know you recently did Lou Dobbs, and Lou wasn't the host. What do you say to America about your experience with immigrants and the children of immigrants?
Well, here's what I say. There's a great line in Malcolm X when he wrote, it had a great effect on me. He said he felt that he was in America, but not of America. One of the reasons the immigrant children who come to my classroom are so well respected is they need to be educated as to how great this country is. These are little kids who maybe have snuck across the border, who have come here even legally, but they know nothing of this country. And the teaching of history in our classrooms has just vanished. I mean, even high school students know nothing. I saw a group of high school kids the other day at Stanford. They were looking at the Hoover Tower. These were high school kids thinking of going to Stanford, and they didn't know who Herbert Hoover was.
Wow.
I mean, come on. And they're trying to get to Stanford? They don't even know he was the president of the United States? So what I say to people is, let's take these children, instead of throwing out of the country, let's educate them as to why this is the greatest country in the world, even though we have our flaws and our spots like the Native Americans and African Americans that we should be ashamed of. It's still the greatest country in the world, and they can be a part of it. We want them to be of America. So once they start to learn their American history, and my students know it religiously, they are proud to be Americans. They're going to contribute to this country. One of my former students, Terry, who's a graduate of MIT in urban planning, is now in the 9th ward, and she's trying to help people get their power on. Why in the world do we want a kid like that taken out of this country?
And she wasn't illegal.
She was illegal from Vietnam.
Okay. Again, the books are There Are No Shortcuts and Teach Like Your Hair is on Fire. The website is HobartShakespeareans.org. One word, HobartShakespeareans.org. Thank you, Rafe Esquith. Keep up the good work. Have a great year.
Good to have it. Thank you, Terry.
Okay.